Welcome to Science Friction Live here at Melbourne Museum and on ABCRN. Oh, I love your work. My name is Natasha Mitchell. This is our last Science Friction Live for 2018, and our topic we are going out with a bang is back from the dead. If we have caused the extinction of other creatures, do we have, panel, a moral obligation to bring them back if we could? Ben?
No.
Now, at face value, biologist Ben Novak's answer to this question is actually really surprising.
My boss, Stuart, might disagree with me. I think he very much sees a moral obligation. A lot of people see a moral obligation, and if it gets them to write checks that fund our project, that's great.
You see, Ben is actually trying to bring back an animal from the dead. One in particular. In fact, he's decided to dedicate his entire life to the cause. Ben is a PhD researcher at Monash University and lead scientist with the conservation organisation Revive and Restore. So they're using the tools of biotechnology to try to resurrect animals that have gone extinct, to effectively engineer them back into being. Even the woolly mammoth, which died out, you know, like 4,000 years ago. This is not science fiction. This is real, but it's certainly a quest, as you'll hear, full of science friction. You'll meet two other panellists in a moment, but Ben's obsession, and he's had it since his teens, is to bring back a pigeon. Not just any old pigeon, the passenger pigeon, the last one of which died in 1914.
If we go back 150 years ago, there were about maybe a billion or fewer people, and there were 5 billion passenger pigeons. It was the most abundant bird, if not the most abundant non-human species on the planet. Vertebrate species, for all those single-cell people out there yelling in the back of their head, microbes outnumber us, trillions to one.
So there were a hell of a lot of passenger
pigeons.
Were they a scourge?
It depended on your definition of what a scourge is. I mean, the really unique thing about them, so unique, rather than existing in a population that's spread out over a large area, these 5 billion birds might have been 2 or 3 flocks of birds. The largest flock on record may have been 3.4 billion birds in a single flock. And so, you know, there were people in Pennsylvania that might go 3-4 years without seeing them, and then they were there.
And like locusts.
Like locusts, yeah. And depending on, you know, your situation, they were either a pest or a bounty. So there were, you know, instances of military units marching that if the pigeons hadn't come through, they would have starved to death. And then you see all the records in history and the pigeons come through and people go, oh, there's nothing better than pigeon pie. And then 3 weeks later, they're like, if I see another pigeon, I'm going to kill myself. And so it is this really unique system. And it's something so grand that we don't really have anything similar today. The African quileia is the closest thing we have. They're a flock of maybe about 1 billion birds.
And so what impact did they have
on the
ecosystems that they occupied? Because this is part of your motivation.
Yeah.
You want to bring them back so that you can replicate the role that they used to have in their environment.
Yeah. And this is where I think the investment in trying to recreate an extinct species becomes really clear, is that I do say we need to focus on modern, present day, and the future of our ecosystems. And people will say, well, you need to invest all of your time in endangered species. And quite frankly, there are many endangered species that are completely gone. They're hanging on by just the fact that we keep them around in a zoo. And there's really no hope for them unless we do complete total restoration of their habitats, a lot of effort. And in the eastern United States right now, we have this phenomenon where there's more forest habitat than there has been in 100, 150, some places 400 years. The forest is coming back, and most of the species living in the forest are still declining. And 50 years ago in conservation, they would have said that's impossible. They would have said habitat's everything. As long as you have habitat, the species are fine. And that's not it. It's about the dynamics happening in the habitat.
So what would the passenger pigeon do if it lived in that forest?
So passenger pigeons, when 1 billion of them came into an area, they overcrowded branches, they broke them off of trees, they caused so much chaos and mayhem. And if we think about this for a second, they deposited so much crap that the accounts show, like, literally feet on the forest floor, that they essentially did the same thing as a hurricane and a forest fire combined. Their guano was snuffing out life on the forest floor, they were destroying trees, and that seems horrible. But the thing that happens the moment they leave is sunlight is hitting that forest floor, which is now enriched in fertilizer, and you get a complete regeneration of new plants, brushes, flowers, you get new animals coming in. And with a flock of a billion birds moving from one spot to another continuously, they were constantly keeping that regeneration process going. And for decades, humans used to think it was fire. And we started really investigating that, and it turns out that passenger pigeons were likely the major driver of that regeneration process for 50,000, 200,000, possibly the last million years.
Okay, so you've worked out that they played this vital role. You want to recreate that chaos by recreating, resurrecting the passenger pigeon. Just before I come to my other panelists, how do you do that? Like, are you starting with a little bit of tissue from a dead passenger pigeon that's been preserved in aspic? Do you start with a near living relative and work your way back?
So for starters, de-extinction is kind of a misleading term. We are creating what I call a precise hybrid. So we take that bit of tissue from a museum specimen, like what you saw outside, the thylacine or the Huia birds, you know, take a little chunk off of its toe, and it's really small, about the size of a pinhead, and we sequence its genome from that. And it's not an easy task, but we have done that so far.
Assuming it hasn't degraded.
Oh, even if it's degraded, we can do it. The idea, and this is pretty far out, we're not there yet. I will echo that for the people who actually know something about this in the audience. Sequence a genome, compare it to the living template, find the mutations, and then the idea is you use some sort of technology. Right now, CRISPR-Cas9 is the revolution that made this possible.
Which is a form of gene editing.
Yep, gene editing, to then put those mutations into your living species, and in effect, from your living species, you recreate the extinct one.
So you're reverse engineering an existing band-tailed
pigeon? For our project,
pigeon?
It's the band-tailed pigeon. Band-tailed pigeons are 97% identical to passenger pigeons at the DNA level. They're ecologically about 99% the same. You know, it'd be even feasible to just introduce band-tail pigeons into the Eastern United States. But the one key difference is band-tail pigeons do not form dense flocks.
So they don't behave the same.
Yeah, they would never produce the same dynamic. So at the bare minimum, the one thing we can do is edit the DNA of a band-tail pigeon so that they become hypersocial. And then we have a species capable of resuming that role in nature as long as we nurture it. And it will take, it's not just about DNA, it will take a bit of context and environment. But this is not actually new. The idea of replacing an extinct species, an extinct population, is actually the very first form of conservation. It goes back to the 1830s. And it's been used to save species, but it's also been used more and more often to restore ecological dynamics. And the beautiful thing about the idea of the apex predator with the thylacine is we have this excellent example in the United States of the wolves in Yellowstone National Park, where they brought in an apex predator. It had been gone for 70 years.
And the beavers came back.
And the beavers came back on their own.
And the beavers came back.
So concurrently, we have this really big push in the conservation arena called rewilding, which is exactly to do that. So to bring back animals that we know have really important roles that completely transform habitats and ecosystems.
That's Ewan Ritchie joining the fray now here on Science Friction Live as we discuss the possibility that we might be able to resurrect extinct species using genetic science. Ben Novak is already on the way. So what does Ewan, Associate Professor in Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin University, think of this ambitious effort?
Don't get me wrong, I would love to see a thylacine. There would be nothing that would make me happier. But if we don't focus on what we're losing right now... It doesn't bear thinking about. I have two children and it makes me cry sometimes thinking about what we're doing to the planet and all the wonderful biodiversity we have. And we need to learn the lessons from the past. Think about, you know, how wonderful evolution is and how long it takes species to evolve. Imagine walking into the most beautiful museum and taking all the artworks off those shelves and burning them, throwing them in the bin, losing them. That's what we're doing with species. Every day, all over the world. And often with basically barely a whimper. And so, as someone who works on the environment and works to conserve species, it's galling to see what's happening to our species.
Many, like Ewan, argue that we are in the thick of the sixth mass extinction event in the entire history of the Earth. So on par with what wiped out the dinosaurs. Only this time the cause is one big-brained species. Us, Homo sapiens. So, Ewan, if we could bring a passenger pigeon back, or a woolly mammoth, or a heath hen, there's another project that's underway. What do you make of that possibility, if we could do it genetically?
Science is a wonderful thing, and I think we can learn a lot from attempting to do such things. I mean, what you're doing is an experiment, right? We don't know what's going to happen, but there is so many species on the list. You know, where would you start? Where would you prioritise? Which ones do you choose? And ecological function, so, you know, what they do in the environment is absolutely important, and a thylacine is a perfect example of that, a top predator. We don't have an animal that size anymore in Tasmania fulfilling that role.
So shaping the landscape
shaping all the landscape.
Species in it.
But the other thing, of course, we must bear in mind too is that we have recent extinctions and we have ones that have occurred much further in the past. And following those extinctions, of course, the environments have changed. So even if you brought those species back, would the habitat be suitable? Or if you brought them back, would those species potentially become almost akin to an invasive species that would then modify the ecology again because the species and the communities that are currently existing have now basically evolved and adapted in the absence of those species, and you're introducing something completely novel to them? So there's a whole range of really complex ecological arguments and problems to sort of think about. And, you know, there's a recent piece of research that came out and said even if we stop doing what we're doing now, it might take 6-7 million years for species or Earth's biodiversity to recover from the losses that we've already sustained. You know, think about that for a second. You know, we've been around for less than 1 million years, and think what we've done to the planet. It's profound. But I mean, I'm not against bringing things back. And, you know, I remember this wonderful story that John Monarski, who's quite a famous scientist in Australia who works on mammals, and he tells this quite sad story of an Indigenous lady in Northern Australia who they took specimens of extinct mammals from Northern Australia, from particular regions around, to get information about when they might have disappeared. And she was holding this northern quoll that was prepared in her lap and stroking it and crying, telling the story of this animal. And you think, well, you know, there's such a deep connection there for her with this animal that maybe in situations like this, you know, there's a cultural argument aside from the scientific and ecological argument for bringing these animals back. So it comes back to your values. So,
although some say that it's the ultimate act of scientific hubris, in a sense, or technological hubris, that we think we can kind of recreate nature as it's evolved over many millennia.
Yeah, I mean, we're modifying everything. Whether you know, say that we're modifying too much by bringing things back, we're modifying things now. So I guess, again, it just comes back to what's your justification for doing that and what are your values? And so I think if there's an argument to say that by bringing this animal back, bringing this plant back, bringing this organism back, that it might be beneficial overall for the environment, then maybe that's a really good thing. But there's other arguments as well, just the wonder of these things. You know, who doesn't want to see a mammoth, right? I mean, it'd be an amazing thing, but would a mammoth have environments that are suitable now? We don't know. And even if you brought back mammoths, would there be predators?
Oh, yes, we do.
No, I'm just posing that as a question to consider. But
the project with the mammoth is re-engineering an Asian elephant be a woolly mammoth.
What would regulate mammoths now? So would you have to bring back predators? In which case, you're talking about potentially bringing back some quite large predators. And would people like that? There's so many questions to think about. And when you think about how complex, you know, food webs and ecosystems are, you know, where does it end? So
another question for you. What about the politics of this? So is this a kind of distraction from funding existing conservation efforts to stop other creatures disappearing and leaping over, you know, the edge of existence? But also, does it sort of change our psychology? Well, if these animals are going to go extinct, well, you know, we've got the biotech one day, potentially, to recreate them as long as we retain a little sample and freeze it and pull it out of the freezer later to re-engineer it. Does it mean that we become complacent about loss?
Yeah, many people have said that conservation needs extinction because without extinction, there's no argument for conservation.
Wow.
And that's a pretty kind of interesting concept to think about. And it's sad that we even have to sort of put it, you know, in those terms. So I don't know whether that's the case. And in an ideal world, of course, there would be resources for both bringing species back as well as conserving species. And I'm not saying that there isn't. So, you know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. So I think arguments saying, well, if we do this, we can't do that are not actually that helpful. But again, it would depend on the context. So, you know, even if you brought back the thylacine, you know, would all its habitat be there? And how much would that cost to fix all the habitat issues and what caused it to go extinct in the first place? So it's going to really vary species by species. So the opportunity cost that you're asking about if you do this, you know, what does that not allow us to do is really context dependent.
So now let's meet Dr. Christy Hipsley. She's an evolutionary biologist and paleontologist at Museums Victoria and the University of Melbourne. Her job is very cool. She's all about looking deep into evolutionary time to understand the ancient past and genetic present of animals like lizards and frogs, but also more recently, that iconic species, the well and truly dead and gone thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger. And some have contemplated, as you will have heard, bringing back the thylacine from extinction too. But to do what Ben Novak is attempting to do with the passenger pigeon, you have to have a very clear picture of the genome you're trying to replicate or resurrect. But you know, that's only the beginning. Christy, how do you see the sort of genetic challenge of this, of recreating a species that's disappeared? Mm. It's not necessarily going to be the species that actually disappeared. It'll be a kind of proxy, doppelganger.
That's right, yeah. And the challenges, I think, also vary wildly depending on what species you're talking about. So in the case of the Tasmanian tiger or thylacine, it's marsupial, right? So although it looks very much like a dingo or a wolf, it had a pouch. In the late 1800s, there was a bounty put on their heads because they thought they were killing sheep. Sheep farmers don't like that very much. So sometimes when people would kill a mother, they would have little joeys in their pouch, just like happens with other marsupials. And in this case, one mother had four little joeys in her pouch, and they wound up here at the museum. And one of those, a little female about 2 weeks old, just happened for whatever reason to be preserved well enough that we could get out DNA. So the problem there, the first problem, is that DNA is very fragmented because over time DNA degrades even in the best conditions. So that means that out of the whole genome, which in this case is about 3 billion base pairs, so a base pair is just one letter of your DNA, the fragments we were getting out were about 100, 150 base pairs. So that's lots of little pieces of a puzzle. So that's kind of step number one. The next part of that is, like all mammals, I think about half of the genome are just repeats. So we used to call that junk DNA. Now we kind of know that probably does play important roles, but that would mean about having a puzzle box of 10 million pieces and the picture is blue sky. Yeah. Right, because we don't really know where they fit.
Yep.
So we use, I think any of these cases with an extinct animal, you use kind of a template or a scaffold. So an animal where you can get a complete genome out, you know, in long pieces, and you try to use that, hopefully something closely related.
So in this case, did you use the dingo?
We used the devil, Tasmanian devil.
Oh, the Tasmanian devil.
Yeah, so but we can kind of see, okay, here are some long sections of these repeats, but it's still something that, you know, remains to be perfected.
And then the challenge is you can't really elucidate anything about behaviour necessarily from the genome that you recreate.
So that's it's fascinating hearing the stories about passenger pigeons because, you know, like we did with the thylacine, humans lived alongside them for a long time and you have fantastic accounts of their behaviour, their flocks. With thylacine, that's really not the case. So I'm sure you've all seen this kind of grainy footage of one moving around in a zoo, but I think most of us know if you take a wild animal and you put it in a cage, it's not really behaving naturally. Yeah, they throw it some meat, it eats the meat, but that's almost all we have. There would not one single scientific study of a thylacine while they were alive. So everything that we do now, we do using basically museum material. So all these specimens that we have here in Melbourne Museum, for example, we have skins, we have skulls, we have skeletons, and we have very, very few of these pouch young specimens, which when you're trying to piece together the story, the life, and the growth of an animal, those early stages are really important. When we get into the development, another big difference between marsupials and other mammals, like placentals like us or dogs, that have a very long gestation period. In marsupials, it's very, very short. And they are only in the uterus for a couple of weeks. And yet another complication is that while they're coming down the tube, that little embryo basically gets like a shell coating around it. It's actually called a shell coat, and that's specific to marsupials. So you would have to, any kind of gene editing you do, a manipulation, you'd have to get it back into
at
that.
At what point do you do the gene editing?
So yeah. You'd have to get it back at least, you know, at the methods that we're looking at now at a very, very early stage.
I think the challenge that we have here too is that we're talking about bringing back individuals. We're not talking about bringing back populations and viable, you know, when species often get below magic numbers like 5,000 or 500, we often see really big genetic consequences, and they often sort of go in this negative vortex and spiral towards extinction for a whole range of reasons. So to bring them back the other way, you have those same challenges, you know, in terms of genetic diversity, but also behaviour. So, you know, how do these animals socialise? How do they behave? And how do we recreate that? And if we don't recreate that, does it matter? It's one thing to talk about bringing back individuals from the dead, but it's a whole other thing to talk about bringing back whole populations and species.
We've overcome this challenge literally dozens of times with endangered species. A Myelin black robin, which went down to a single female.
What is it? A robin.
Yeah, a robin. And there's 250 of them today. And they went to a single female and three males. The Mauritius kestrel went to four. Well, exactly. But it's the same process.
But it's different. They're extinct.
No, it's absolutely the same. It's 100% the same because they went down to four and we bred them back up. Let's say we create four. Then we breed them back up. It's the same thing.
But you're talking about species where you knew their ecology, their behavior, their life history.
And that's one of the beauties of, you know, this is a very different conversation in the United States. I almost feel actually kind of horrible being here in Australia talking about it because all of your extinct species are incredibly unique. You know almost nothing about them. I would not advocate de-extinction in this country. I would not.
And I guess that's my point. That
because they wouldn't survive
so
or thrive.
Many species yeah. that we know so little about. So to bring them back is really challenging. So I completely agree with you. They are good examples of bringing things back.
And the
but we knew stuff about them.
Whereas messed up.
I mean, you just said how little we knew about the thylacine. Mm. That's one of our most iconic mammals, and we know so little about it. Mm. So
I always think of these things as kind of, okay, there maybe if the end goal is de-extinction, it's a whole process along the way. And during that process, we learn a lot about biology. We learn a lot about animals, their habitats, earth history, you know, those same techniques you can use to maybe inject more genetic diversity into a population that's already kind of going through a bottleneck. You could maybe insert resistant genes into a population. So Tasmanian devil, you know, trying to release populations that are resistant to this cancer disease. So I think there's so many applications of it that often aren't factored into the cost.
So we could borrow from the technology that's being utilized by de-extinction efforts to inform biodiversity efforts today.
Yeah, and those are so many different avenues, and all of those have different costs and you know, risks and outputs.
Yeah, so I guess it comes back to what would we learn that we wouldn't, that we don't already know, in the sense, so you mentioned increasing genetic diversity as an example, and mountain pygmy possums are a great example of that, where they moved possums from Mount Hotham to Mount Buller to essentially genetically rescue the Mount Buller population, and it worked. Well, we think it's worked because their population size has increased and it's increased genetic diversity. So we actually did that with living, you know, a living species. So I guess, again, it's a common argument that, oh, we could learn all these things by going down the de-extinction path, but the question is, are we actually learning anything new or not? So, and I'm not saying I don't know the answer.
Biotechnology has real tangible hope. It's not just learning about de-extinction like it's something new and on the horizon. In the United States, there's something called the American chestnut tree. It was once the most abundant tree in the eastern United States forests. And when Asian chestnut trees were brought over as ornamental trees, they introduced a fungus that killed off 99% of the species. It's clung on in a couple spots, but essentially it can never recolonize its habitat. It's been functionally extinct for nearly a century. And over the last 20 years, using traditional genetic engineering technologies, a team has brought in a single gene from wheat into this tree, and they now have American chestnuts that are 100% immune to this disease. And that's the first example of biotechnology successfully saving a species. Now, it's a long road because they haven't planted them. They haven't replanted them. There's a lot of regulatory nature to go through here. But now they have an organism that can be replanted throughout its distribution and live through this disease and rejoin the modern ecosystem. And we can learn from that, and we can learn from what we're doing, and we can continue. Revive and Restore works with the black-footed ferret. We're trying to save it from plague. We just funded a project trying to figure out genes involved in coral bleaching. You know, we get a lot of recognition for passenger pigeons and mammoths, but this is about basically a technology that can really help on many, many fronts that traditional methods are just not able to solve. We live on this planet in such a dominating way that we get to choose how we live here. And the choice is, do we want to live in a planet that's impoverished for the entire duration of our existence? Or do we want to live in one that is, you know, beautiful the entire time we're here?
And rich and diverse.
You know, do we want trees and prairies to clean our air? Or do we want giant atmospheric scrubbers made out of steel and concrete? it is a matter of choice. And that's the crux of conservation.
Absolutely.
Is a lot of people actually think that a highly technological world is an okay substitute. And that's just really sad to all of us that actually care about the other several million species on the planet that now live on half of the planet's resources. Human beings use more than half of the entire Earth's resources, yeah. And that's astonishing.
Now look, this week, allegedly, the first ever gene-edited babies were born via the work of a Chinese scientist. So is it not inevitable that we might use biotechnology to return creatures from extinction? Christy?
Yeah, it indicates we're on the way, and it depends, maybe not in my lifetime. Well, I just, you know, it's a time issue. Okay. I think it's probably not if, it's when.
I sure hope so. It's my job.
Yeah.
and it's potentially highly commercially lucrative. So if
how
you're
so?
The first person to bring back a mammoth, can you imagine how much that's worth? Someone will not do it.
Well, we say that, but, you know, this is the reality about the cost issue. Is a revive and restore, we operate on very small amounts of money. We're talking less than $5 million. The Nature Conservancy is a $350 million organization. And so I actually take quite offense sometimes when people accuse us that we're taking money away from conservation, because we have almost nothing compared to these conservation groups that have been well established.
Yes, the idea, though, of taking money away from conservation, the argument there is that if you did succeed in resurrecting a species, getting to that stage is expensive, but also getting that species to then exist and live and thrive is also expensive.
Well, it depends on what you're comparing it to. And this is where I find that we have these conversations. I'm noticing a lot of white faces in the room. And we have these conversations in a European Anglo echo chamber. And that's why I loved when Ewan brought up the indigenous culture side of things, because we in Western conservation have drawn this weird baseline that the day Europeans set foot somewhere is the ecosystem that matters. And Australia is a great place for this argument, because human beings were here engineering these habitats, hunting these species, and changing the evolution of this continent for nearly 70,000 years. Human beings are a natural entity on this planet. We have been everywhere for thousands of years. It's just white people haven't been everywhere for thousands of years. And these conversations don't take into differences of cultural opinion into the value of species. Now, in California, they spend that money on the California condor because it's a majestic animal. And conservation has created a really big problem. They say, save everything because we're going to lose it. And it's created such a huge problem over the decades, that especially in the United States and Europe, that people don't want to fund it anymore because all they see is failure. Because we don't tote the things we've done really well. Like, the California condor has a long road ahead, but it is breeding in the wild. Last year, they produced more chicks in the wild than any year before, more chicks in the wild than in captivity. So we are making wins, and if we keep putting the work in, we will continue to win. We need to learn from our mistakes. We need to continue to innovate.
Are you hopeful? Do you think by the end of your lifetime, you will have a flock of passenger pigeons released into the wild and surviving?
I'm hoping in the next 25
years. And causing
years.
The carnage that you hope they yeah. will cause. You think?
25 years, yeah.
That's your...
Now,
that's
that
your...
depends on if the money rolls in.
My point about lucrative was not saying that you're getting lots of money, was just saying that...
Once it's done, though, yeah.
That's my point. So if you could make a mammoth, can you imagine how much you could charge to have people come and see that thing?
Do you think that's a good thing to be doing?
Well, that's a question on values. So, you know, what do you get out of that? I mean, it's a good thing the person who owns the mammoth, but, you know, I don't know whether that's a good thing or not.
I'll say one thing about the gene editing in humans conversation is about 10 years ago in a class on genomics, a professor asked, should we genetically engineer people? And of the people in the classroom, all but two of us said no. And I find that once again, you know, bringing this back to cultural echo chambers, it's oftentimes that we have these conversations where extremely healthy people talk in a room about the future of medicine. And Tay-Sachs disease is a disease that kills an infant within the first 3 to 4 years of its life. And it's a single letter in its DNA
mutation,
that's wrong.
That's right, yeah.
And CRISPR-Cas9 right now,
could
at a single-celled embryo level, can fix that disease.
And that's a very big conversation, which is almost another Science Friction Live, I think. I'm going to come to you now. We've got roving mics. We'd love to hear from you. Questions for our panel. Let it rip, please. Hands up. Yes, thank you.
When humans become extinct, do you think the life forms that remain should and would want to reinvent us or bring us back?
It depends what comes, what takes over from us, I think.
They should edit us to be more puppy-like. You know, that's kind of what we've done with all of our pets. If you start with a wolf, you kind of choose the... I mean, not with gene editing. We did it with selection, you know, that we choose traits that are
make
very
us more
childlike.
Cute.
Yeah, so maybe we'll have kind of big floppy ears and
once,
big feet.
Once octopi, you know, manage to drive cars and bear arms, we're in a lot of trouble.
In all seriousness, I actually think it would be an immense act of stupidity or super catastrophe that would end the human race. We are the only species that can actually possibly never go extinct. And this is going to seem far-fetched, but it's not. So we already do IVF. Anyone in the room born from IVF? There we go. The first IVF-born human being turned 40 this year. Now, imagine this. We know how to cryopreserve sperm. We know how to cryopreserve eggs. We know how to cryopreserve embryos. We now have AIs that are telling us, you know, what we should respond to in our emails. So if you imagine that in the future some horrible, horrible event happens, but we have created sustainable energy and we have a biobank of human embryos, artificial uteri, which are on the way, it's not impossible to think that an AI kicks on automatically, powered by the sun, and sticks a whole bunch of embryos and artificial uterus and raises a brand new generation. And we were only blipped out for about 2 months.
In our lifetime, folks. In our lifetime. Another question.
Once you've released an extinct species back into the wild, what's the next step? Where do you go from there?
If you're bringing it back for what people have been arguing for, that it has a really important role, you know, whether it's to, you know, regulate other species to perform an important function, you'd want to measure that and see whether that's true and see whether that's beneficial or not. Because as I said before, you might bring something back
and it becomes feral.
Becomes an invasive species in a sense, because the system, the community has adapted to the point where it no longer, you know, has that as part of it, and now you're destabilizing it again.
And it'll be a genetically modified organism.
And it won't be exactly the same, or it's unlikely to be exactly the same.
I would say we also would just do very careful, controlled monitoring of that system. So I don't think anyone argues we do this and then we just throw them out and that's the end. You know, these are experiments. We're testing hypotheses. We're trying to learn something along the way. So these would be managed, very, very carefully managed populations.
Depending on the species. So, you know, if it's a land-based mammal, really easy to contain. If it's a bird or an aquatic species, much harder.
What you do after is actually very much a part of the strategy of planning before.
I just want to take it back a little bit because you were talking first about it's better to sort of stop the extinction of animals. And, you know, besides sort of bringing my grocery bag to the grocery store and trying to recycle, what types of things should we be doing on a grander scale? Like, you know, influencing political decisions, stuff like that, that actually help to sustain what we have and make the changes that we can make without introducing science but changing human behavior for
the better
planet.
We turn to an engineering solution for
re-engineering. How do we best sort of work to change human behavior on the planet on a larger scale?
Okay, the politicians are listening.
So the biggest threat to species at the moment unquestionably is habitat loss, and one of the major drivers of habitat loss is agriculture, particularly for the production of meat. So eating meat has a huge impact on the environment, and of course it is compounding climate change. So climate change is a big issue in itself, but habitat
loss...
But
we clear land for vegetables too.
We can, and you need a lot less, and you need a lot less
water.
That's
actually not true.
Well, we can have that debate, but my point is I think there are things that we could do, as you're getting at, as individuals as well as governments, to actually have a substantial change. And the other thing we could do in an Australian context is invest a lot more in conservation. So, you know, the US, as an example, invests billions in their threatened species to conserve them. We invest an absolute fraction of that.
But actually, what would you do with the money if you had more?
Well, you could manage habitats. You could set aside habitats. There's a whole range of things you could do that we just currently don't have the resources for. So we're a long way short. And the thing is, it's actually not that expensive. So if you had $2 billion, as an example, like tomorrow, for threatened species, you could make an absolutely transformative change in conservation of our species. And $2 billion, that is nothing in Australia's budget. And yet we still can't seem to find the way to do that. You could flick the switch tomorrow and you'd see a transformative change of conservation in Australia.
In the United States, what pains me is, you know, we could put an extra dollar on every flight that comes into Hawaii, and Hawaii would have tens of millions of extra dollars every year for conservation. There's so many little tiny ways we could do this that no one would care about. And in the United States, this is something fundamentally different from Australia. So I am a hunter. And in the United States, the largest amount of money that comes to conservation is from hunting. More than $8 to $10 billion comes in a year from hunting revenue. And hunters have actually voted for these taxes. They've said, put more money on our guns, put more money on our bullets, as long as it goes to protecting habitat. It's actually gone into engineering habitats. 5 years ago, I went to a meeting in Indiana, and afterwards they took us out to eat at this recreational spot in the middle of a wetland, and they said, last year this was a farm field. And they had gone back to the maps, seen what it was like in 1850, they'd re-sculpted the landscape after they bought it, and they filled it with water, filled it with plants, and then tens of thousands of birds stopped over. It's a new ecosystem.
I'm intrigued that you're reviving a resurrecting species or attempting to, and you're a hunter as well. There's so much to talk about. thank you.
Once you resurrect an animal, do you have then an obligation to that animal? If it's no longer viable or it is an invasive species, do you let it go extinct again?
Oh, if it becomes invasive, you purposefully make it go extinct again.
You wouldn't find another location for it? If it's expensive to make,
if it's invasive in the place it's supposed to go, it's probably going to be invasive in most other places. But I got asked to do a show about Frankenstein's monster. And I told them, I said, I'm not going to do that show. That's bad PR. unless they actually understand the real meaning behind Frankenstein. Frankenstein is not about not creating the monster. It's about the fact that Dr. Frankenstein
abandoned
his monster, his creation. It's about lack of nurturing. So the very moment we create anything, it's our responsibility and our obligation to nurture that into being. And that's why, you know, I say I've dedicated my life to this, is even though I say we're going to put them back in the wild in 10, 20, 25 years, I anticipate it'll be my entire life and other people's lifetimes watching how these species, you know, reacclimate and change their environments and really take hold.
One final question.
At what point do you determine the money spent on reviving these species would be better spent on conserving the current existing species?
I guess that's assuming that there's that the budget is finite in terms of that if you use money for for bringing species back, that means less for conserving. So if there was, as an example, a billionaire that came along and said, look, I want to bring things back, and that's all they wanted to do, then that's a different situation. So that's a really tricky question to
compared to public funding. And people have done the Hugh Possingham and colleagues.
So there's been studies, and
Of this comparison.
It's a classic argument that comes out for not doing it. But as I said before, I think, you know, in conservation, we have to acknowledge that we can walk and chew gum. You know, we can do two things at once. So we'd have to think really carefully, you know, is there a potential for detriment? But I think the bigger question for me is, if you start going down this path of bringing things back, what does that do for conservation? So do we then slip into this sort of negligent kind of, or more negligent than we already are, idea that we can let things go extinct because we can bring them back?
We can bring them back. Mm-hmm. What an intriguing frontier that we've been talking about tonight. Join me, please, in thanking Ben Novak, Ewan Ritchie and Christy Hipsley. Well, given that this last week saw the announcement of the alleged first ever gene-edited babies born in China, I wonder if it's only a matter of time before biotechnology helps bring extinct creatures alive again. We'll pick up that question in the podcast. Talk to me, tweet me. I'm at Natasha Mitchell, hashtag science friction. Next week, a season of your and our favourite science friction shows from the year through into the new year. Get your mates to subscribe to the podcast. And good luck with your silly season preparations or escape plans. Thanks to the team, co-producer Maria Tickle, engineers Tim Simons and Richard Gervin. Catch ya.